What's really good, everybody? This is Nathan Alabach, and welcome to the podcast where we get into people's stories and go down a bunch of rabbit holes about what's really good in the world. For today's episode, I wanted to do something a little different and give you all some backstory on who I am. I've never done any type of solo podcast before, but I figured we're 20 episodes into this thing, and I've been interviewing a bunch of incredible people, while the majority of listeners don't really know much about me at all. So I tried to keep it interesting, even though I'm not really sure how interesting I am. I get into what it was like growing up in a very strong, close-knit religious community, then what it was like to rebel against it and eventually go through a quarter-life crisis type of mental breakdown, aka the Weezer Cruise, as some of you have heard me allude to in the past. Then I get into what it was like to come back out of that, trying to reconstruct some form of stability, and then deconstructing my identity again and reconstructing it to where I am today. Sort of. So I go all over the place, and one of the things that I kept trying to be consciously aware of while recording was just how privileged I've been to exist and grow up in the circumstances that have been handed to me. And I don't mean that to be self-dismissive, like some people often do with the word privilege, but more so in the sense of being self-aware, because understanding how your overall identity fits into the world's social and geopolitical conversations is more important today than it's ever been. And I think it's possible to hold in one hand the reality that, yes, I've had a life full of struggle that is very real to me and has created real consequences in the world, while holding in the other hand that I've also had one of the luckiest decks of cards handed to me in human history by being born into such a loving, stable family and community and country that has provided me with the building blocks to be on so many of the platforms that I am on today. So yeah, I ramble a bunch and barely scratch the surface on any of the topics I bring up. So if you want to know more about any of them, feel free to hit me up on Twitter or email or wherever else. I don't normally have announcements or anything before episodes, but here's one. I'm getting married to my fiance Chelsea at the end of this month, which is huge, obviously. A lot of you have interacted with her on Twitter the past couple months, which has been a ton of fun. We've been trying to schedule a podcast together, so hopefully after the wedding chaos is over, we can make that happen and you can get to know her a little bit more too. I've got some great interviews coming out in the next couple weeks, and I just really appreciate all of you for being part of this, whether it's been through my Twitter family, or Instagram, or the Reddit subs I've been posting in, or even if you're just someone who saw a link being shared on Facebook or YouTube and you thought you'd give it a listen. This is something I've wanted to do for years, and just never had the time or resources to put into it, so I'm really honored to be here now with such a diverse and thoughtful group of individuals listening and participating. So yeah, you all rule. And if you haven't yet, it'd mean a ton if you'd give an honest review of the show on iTunes. That helps with visibility more than anything else. And if you don't use iTunes and you want to get me feedback, I'm available on pretty much every social media channel at this point if you just search my name. So yeah, come say hi. And I think that's everything. Okay, I hope you enjoy my clumsy hour-long biographical rant. All right, now let's get into what's really good. All right, let's do this. It is so strange for me right now to be talking at my computer alone about myself. So if at any point any of you feel uncomfortable, trust me, I feel much more uncomfortable. And we're just going to keep sharing in this uncomfortable space. So yeah, I already went through in the intro why I'm doing this. I just want to provide some more context for people who listen to this podcast on a weekly basis, since I'm not some public figure. I'm not an author or a person with a giant platform that you can just search the internet through and find, you know, the bits and pieces of who I am and what I've done and all that nonsense. I'm just some guy that wanted to start a podcast. So Thought I'd just give you some little pieces of information about myself, try to not bore you entirely. I will do my best to hit the highs and the lows and give my most honest biographical take of who I am, even though, of course, if you want the real stuff, you got to go to the people who know me in my life. So I'll do my best here. So anyway, my name is Nathan, obviously. I grew up in the suburbs outside of Philadelphia. My parents started a church with a few other families when I was maybe 8 years old. They were looking to get outside the more traditional church structures that existed in the area at the time, and they wanted to start something new that they felt called to do. So yeah, they started a non-denominational church, which for the sake of labels, it became sort of a mix of Pentecostal and Christian fundamentalist beliefs. It fit under the evangelical umbrella. There was a heavy emphasis on the gifts of the Spirit. So they believed that, you know, people in today's world are still capable of speaking in tongues and performing miracles, and that the Spirit of God was and is very much active and alive in the world today. So it was a mix of that, and then also a mix of taking the Bible very seriously, mostly in the literal sense. Obviously, some give room with parables and all that, but like taking the Old Testament very literally, stories like the creation story, you know, Adam and Eve, very literally. All the Old Testament stories literally happened. So there's sort of that mix of some like progressive or more fringe ideas under the broader American evangelicalism scope. But at the same time, there was that reverence for the structure in which they came from. So yeah, anyway, I was really close to my family growing up, but naturally rebelled in my teen years. A lot of my best friends were the social outcasts, the scene kids, emo kids, which at the time, this was like 2004, 2005-ish, that was not a popular thing at the time. We were sort of the weird countercultural almost in our stupid little suburb outside of Philadelphia. But anyway, a lot of the people that I was friends with, they got into drugs, and we were just very rebellious in a lot of the senses, at least in our social context. So anyway, when I got into high school, my parents were really worried about me. They thought, oh, he's straying off the path in some sense. And they thought that sending me to a private school would help realign me, which they couldn't have been more wrong, unfortunately. I mean, obviously, I knew their hearts were in the right place, but they sent me to this school and I did not fit in whatsoever. I barely made a single friend there. I mean, I kind of weaved in between a couple different social circles over the 2 years that I was there, but I got bullied relentlessly by a lot of the older kids, and it was a Christian school. So I was sort of in the process of rebelling against that faith, and now I'm put into a box with a very small school, very intimately organized group of people. So I didn't really have any safe place to get away from all that from. You know, I was just day to day inundated with this culture, which parts of it I appreciated. You know, there were still parts of it. It's always weird talking about it in this sense because you give off the idea that it's all bad. It's all bad. It wasn't that it was all bad. There were parts of it I appreciated. You know, some of the teachers there were amazing, but the culture as a whole, like especially for a young, impressionable kid who doesn't really fit into that, there's a lot of just peer pressure and they're trying to assimilate you into the sort of group think there. And I just was not having it. So after 2 years, you know, my parents saw that I was not happy and that it was not helping really any of the personal issues that I was going through. So they allowed me to go back to public school, which was super cool. I'm really grateful that they did that because it was amazing for me at the time. You know, it got me more adaptive socially, and I was able to fit in a lot easier back at public school. So my family, just probably as you can tell, depending on where you're coming from listening to this, you know, they were more conservative. So naturally, so was I growing up. And in the process of all this rebelling, you know, I started to a lot of how I started to oppose their beliefs and just in general rebel was for the sake of rebelling. It was for the sake of opposing them, as it is with most teenagers. You know, it's how much of a actual worldview can you really develop in those years? I mean, nowadays with kids growing up with the internet and all that, they're able to access information at much younger ages, so they can form opinions on social issues and political issues and all that. But at the same time, your brain is so underdeveloped. Even though at the time I was thinking that I was super smart and like I had it all figured out and all that, I didn't know anything about anything. It's like your life experiences are so limited. The scope of how you can understand an issue is so limited, just not even just on the cognitive level, but the social level. So that was sort of me growing up. And I do distinctively remember a couple instances where there was conscious effort of rebellion. It wasn't just out of nothing. There were sermons I remember in the church that I went to where they conflated a lot of conservative American politics with the teachings of Jesus. And that definitely was off-putting to me because I had always known the two things hand in hand growing up together, but never really thought of it in that sense. So just to kind of like throw that into the middle of my rebellious years, that was a very, it just struck a chord with me, I guess, on some level. So anyway, I was kind of drifting away from my family's belief systems, which in this context, if you didn't grow up in this way, like that is everything. The belief structures that create communities, like entire church communities, it isn't just a small part of life. It's a huge part of life. It's the sort of central focus of who you know, like who your friends are, who your family knows, the type of ethical frameworks that you work within. So this wasn't just a small, like, oh, like Nathan is just rebelling, it's just a phase. Like, this was very difficult for my family, for my younger sisters, for my parents, for my grandparents, like the broader family and community at large. So, obviously in the, like looking outward, in the global sense or like the national sense, this is not as crazy now that I have different perspectives. But like at that time, in our community, this was a big thing. So in these teen years, I was really involved in our local music scene. Like I said before, a lot of my best friends were the scenesters and the emo kids. We all wore black and listened to metal and hardcore music. That was, in a lot of ways, sort of the tribal fire that we gathered around to let out our angsty steam in some way. So most of my best friends were in bands, which was really cool. So we'd go out most weekends to see local shows. They'd be playing at the local high schools or the YMCAs or even some of the churches around our area. It would host these concerts every month, which is a really, really cool, vibrant community at this time. This is like the days of Zanga and MySpace. So, you'd see like someone posting about a show on MySpace, and it wasn't like now where you're so flooded with Facebook event invitations where every week there's a bajillion things going on and you get 5 invites for the same night and you wind up doing none of them because there's just so many options to do. So it's a very different time in that sense. It's like this music scene was really everything. Most of my best friends were in bands, but I myself was not talented enough to be in a band at that time. I didn't really get into songwriting until after high school. So when I turned 18 and graduated, I wanted to be a musician. I wanted to get out of my hometown. I wanted to do all these things that were not the norm, but I really didn't have any resources. I wasn't really a smart kid or a very attentive kid in school at any point. Like, just, I guess, sort of fell hand in hand with the rebellious nature. I was always wanting to be somewhere else. I never really wanted to be at school, which, looking back, it's such like a stupid, selfish thing to think, especially when you grew up as privileged as I did. And like, I didn't even know at the time how privileged I really was, at least in the Western sense of the world. Because, when I was, I think for the first time, I was 11 or 12, I went to Honduras on my first missions trip, which my church got involved in. I went back after that probably 10 or so different times over the years. We built this youth center and a school down in Tegucigalpa in Honduras. So at a very young age, I had experienced poverty and the desolation of certain areas like that, where it's just people there literally have nothing. You know, you're walking through the streets and it's people are living in shacks. There's feces on the ground. You're just stray dogs everywhere. Like, there's not... It was a super eye-opening, worldview-shifting thing for me to experience at that age. But at the same time, again, because when you're young like that, you don't have your full cognitive senses developed. It only goes so far. You know, like, it really didn't allow me to understand, like, the broader geopolitical, socioeconomical issues of even just our country. You know, like, I had obviously seen poverty in America, but because at that young age, when you've seen poverty at the scale of something like in Honduras, where I was, it almost, in my stupid teen brain, I would compare the poverty of America to that then and think, oh, people in America don't know how good they have it. And it creates this really just narrow binary mindset, you know, in a young person like that. So but even by the time I was graduating high school, you know, I really didn't have a framework to understand, you know, what I really had. You know, I grew up with my base needs met. I grew up with a really loving family, a really amazing community that provided me with so many opportunities that I wasn't even really fully aware of. You know, I wasn't fully grasping just how good that I had it, but I was still in this ideological rebellious phase where I was trying to figure out who I was and what I believed and what I wanted to do with my life. You know, I knew I didn't want a desk job. I kept thinking that was one of the main things I would always come back to in my mind. I was sort of into anarchy, but in a really light beginner sense, where in my mind I was just like, I don't want to grow up and just get married. I don't want to go to some college and be wasting my time partying and learning things that I don't care about. You know, I don't want a white picket fence and a dog and a family. Like, these were all things that at that young age of around 17, 18, I saw them conceptually in the communities around me, and, you know, in the media as well. And I just didn't want that at all. So when I got out of high school, you know, I just wanted to leave. So I screwed up big time. You know, I wound up blowing all the money I had saved throughout high school, and I was working at a car wash for years and saved up just a couple thousand dollars, you know, like, not a ton of money, but I was able to do some road trips with some friends, do some touring with a couple of my friends' bands that they had been working on at the time. So this was like a really, really lame self-exploration phase. And I came home with no money and no idea what to do. You know, all of the people I knew from high school were away at college. I was not really of the mind that I wanted to do that in any sense. You know, I hadn't signed up to go anywhere because I didn't have the grades or the resume to really put that out there. So I ended up getting a job landscaping, and I just dove headfirst into music promotion and songwriting. So at the same time, while this was all happening, I started dating this girl who was crazy smart and virtually agnostic ideologically, which brushed up against a lot of my previous held beliefs. You know how that is, where even though I was sort of out of that phase, you know, when you're interacting with someone who believes something so staunchly opposed to what you believe, even if it's not something that you strongly believe anymore, like, in this sense, it was beliefs that I had held growing up. It was my family's beliefs. So it still hurt. You know, it still was very, there's a lot of tension between us in that way, because in my mind, I kept thinking this person is pushing up against everything that I thought I knew at one point, and it just doesn't feel right. So anyway, she was really kind and patient with me. Looking back, it's just so funny, because I think, why was she with me in some ways? Like when I think back at some of the rhetoric and the sort of ways I went about my thinking, I really was so rudimentary. And, you know, not to say she was like some insane intellect, I guess, at the time, because we were both 18, but still, she had a pretty strongly developed worldview around skepticism and free thinking, which is something that she got me into. And at the time, I ended up reading a couple of really challenging books, one of the primary ones being Letter to a Christian Nation by Sam Harris. And that led me down the whole rabbit hole of the online skeptic community. I remember just sitting up late at night, like till 2, 3, 4 in the morning sometimes on YouTube, watching like Christopher Hitchens debates and all that, and being so existentially fearful and confused, you know, not knowing what I was gonna do about any of this. You know, I didn't know who I was, I didn't know what I believed, I didn't know what happened after I died. You know, all of a sudden these questions that sort of theoretically just they were in the ether. You know, these were ideas of rebellion that I had in the ether, but these were people who were putting those ideas into very direct and sound arguments, which really just threw me through a loop. So this went on for a few months. You know, while we were dating, my world opened up and I was very confused, like a newborn almost, and then we broke up. So that just really planted just this really, really powerful seed of existential angst into my life that just was never there before. Because all of this, I guess the word I was looking for before was abstract. You know, all of this rebellion was abstract in my life up to this point. Now it felt very real. It felt very visceral. I could feel it. I could feel the doubts within me, which was not something I was used to feeling at all, because I grew up in a community where everything was certain. You know, like the community was, we knew what we believed, we knew who we were, we had answers to all of life's questions in some capacity, and now a lot of that was taken away. You know, like the rug was ripped out from under me, and I didn't know where I fit with any of this, especially because all of my family and friends were still religious. So it's like I broke up with this girl and now I don't really have many resources to turn to. And at the time, you know, I'm 18 and like I said, a lot of the people I knew were away at college, and a lot of the friends that I grew up with were just getting more and more deep into the drug scene and all that. You know, they sort of took, I mean, a lot of them at least took this route into furthering rebellion into that, you know, whether it was coke or meth, you know, or psychedelics, whatever it was. And that was just not something I was ever interested in. So at this point, I held on to songwriting and promoting for dear life. The church I had gone to growing up allowed me to book local concerts there, despite me not attending it anymore, which was super cool. And again, pulling back to this whole concept that even though I was rebelling and leaving a lot of these beliefs and not really knowing where I fit in with the community, the people who I was rebelling against in this community were always so kind. And these people, even though it brushed up against me in really bad ways, you know, when it came to certain major issues and major conflicting points that left me feeling not just uncomfortable, but abused in some sense. Because like when you grow up with that sort of umbrella worldview and then you're outside of it and you're trying to maintain those relationships, a lot of the answers and the ways that they will go about maintaining it and trying to quote unquote fix it is very damaging to people, which is a whole other topic of like abuse in the church, which doesn't people generally associate the word abuse with physical abuse. There's spiritual abuse and emotional abuse, which are very real things. And, you know, I won't dive too deep into that, but there was definitely some points of contention that, you know, I felt really hurt and like abandoned by a lot of these people that I'd grown up with. So there was that element that was always there. And, you know, I think to a certain degree always will be there, because, you know, this is a really powerful developmental stage in my life. So anyway, that was there. But at the same time, there was that sense of just community and forgiveness and openness, which they were always trying to maintain the relationship. And it was a really small community. This isn't like, you know, I didn't grow up in a big city, so there weren't a ton of places to go, you know? So like this was a very tight-knit group of people, and they were always so excited about the different things I wanted to do, you know, even though in this sense where I was like booking shows and I wasn't like, there was no agenda, you know what I mean? Like I wasn't tying this back to church. I wasn't inviting people to go to church or anything. You know, the people who came to these shows, most of them had no idea either it was a church. And if they did know it was a church, there was no like association there where they felt pressured in any way to attend or anything like that. Just to provide even more context around that, the church itself met in like an old warehouse building that we had renovated. And when we renovated it to look sort of like a cafe, just have a more contemporary open feel. It wasn't like when you walked in or drove past, it looked like a church building. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't a space that would have driven people away who were outside of that community. So I got heavily involved in this. I did it for years. I want to say maybe 5 years. I promoted shows there where I'd book one almost every month, all different genres, anything from rock, hardcore, metal, indie music, acoustic music, hip hop, electronic music. I can't even tell you how many people, amazing people, some amazing people, some terrible people that I met over the years doing this. Because again, this is sort of the infancy stages of social media. So there wasn't a ton of vetting. You know, there wasn't like a ton of research involved. You know, you could only know so much about someone or their band before you booked them. You know, a lot of it was just word of mouth and trusting people over email or like, you know, a Facebook page that does not have a lot of identity built into it. So that was a really, really cool thing. And it really helped me sort of restabilize my purpose in life almost, if that makes sense. You know, I put a lot of my energy into that. And simultaneously, I started getting into songwriting and obviously was really bad at first. You know, I'm still not great, but it was really, really bad. And I would kind of like weave that in to what I was doing with the promotion. Sometimes I'd play. I never like booked the shows around myself, but if I needed to like a fill-in act, you know what I mean? Maybe I'd open up acoustically for some of the bands that were playing and stuff like that. So I got really into doing that and recording. You know, I started releasing a couple albums at that time, and I think a lot of this helped distract me from the existential angst that I was feeling deep down. So about, I want to say like 2 years later from all of this, because I was dating this girl who kind of rocked my worldview from 2010 into 2011. So right at the beginning of 2012, I went on a Weezer cruise. And this is the part of the story, and a lot of people have heard me joking about this and talking about it in passing. You know, not a lot of people know the full context of how this event happened and the consequences that came from it. So you're getting the sort of full preface. You're getting the what life was like for me growing up before all this, and then what life was like after all this. There was like a very strong defining curve or arc in my story when this Weezer cruise happened. So at the time, I'd went from landscaping to working for a realty company, and I had become friends with the two kids whose parents ran the company. So long story short, they invited me on this cruise, which was the coolest thing ever. I mean, I never imagined myself being able to go on a cruise before, and it was a lot of really awesome bands that were going to be playing it, and it was like 4 days, I want to say. I went to Mexico, and we shipped out of Florida. Just to tie in everything I've been getting at here with my existential angst, you know, I had been carrying this throughout my teen years of rebelling against the church and my family's beliefs and all that. And now I had been carrying it in this new way for like the past year or year and a half or so of going through that real, very visceral existential break from dating that girl and learning all these new things, not just about the world, but about myself and all that. So I've been carrying that with me and putting it out. Or putting it off with songwriting and promotion and staying busy. You know, I had a new girlfriend at the time. I just started dating her maybe a month before all this. And, you know, I was really trying everything I could possibly do to just push it down. You know, I'd gotten into drinking, not super bad, but, you know, bad enough where it became a coping mechanism. So just keeping that in mind, I carried a lot of this pushed down angst into the cruise. So go on the cruise, and obviously, what do you do on a cruise? You drink and you party. So we had a great time. You know, it was like I said, it was maybe like 4 days or so. And It was really, really fun. Saw a lot of great bands. Of course, got into all sorts of antics on the cruise and was just drinking and eating bad food the entire time, you know, like stuffing my face with burgers and pizza and not sleeping at the right hours, you know, like eating a burger and then going to sleep like an hour later type of thing, and just drinking all day, all night. And I had never really experienced anything at that level. So this all goes on and everything's fine. Everything's all good. And we get to Mexico. You're only there for like a day or whatever it was. And we leave to get back on the cruise. And for the last night of the cruise, before we get back to the port where we landed in Florida, we're able to drink the alcohol that we'd got in Mexico. So we had bought this bottle of Bacardi. And just to not bore you entirely with the story, I don't know, maybe people are bored, maybe you're like really into this, I have no idea, because I've never done or told this type of story, especially alone like this before, or just talking at my computer. But we had bought this bottle of Bacardi, and the last night we were just going ham. I mean, I had probably taken, I want to say, started drinking around 8 or 9 o'clock, drank till maybe midnight, and or 1 in the morning. Probably in that time period, like 13, 14 shots of this stuff. Like, I don't even really remember. It was an absurd amount, more than I had probably ever drank at that point. We were just going crazy and having a good time. And we get back to our room because we have to wake up, I think it was like 6 or 7 the next morning to get off the boat. So we get back to the room, and my buddy who I was with, Leo, he, from what I knew of him, I mean, we'd been friends for maybe a year or so at this point. What I knew of him, he was a heavyweight. You know, he loved to party, and I'd never seen him get sick or anything. We had drank all into the nights, you know, many times before all this. And we're taking these drinks, and he, out of nowhere, starts getting just violently sick. And he's throwing up and getting very obviously nauseous, because when you're drunk, you're nauseous, but he's kind of like, his equilibrium's all off, and we're on a moving boat, which is probably a large factor in all of this, but it's still like when you're super drunk like that, you're not really thinking rationally, and everything felt very confusing. And needless to say, he, over the course of the next 10, 15 minutes, I'm like trying to make sure that he's okay and not actually sick. And he's just mumbling, you know what I mean? Just passed out, basically saying, leave me alone, I'm fine. And in my extreme drunken mind at that time, you know, I'm left alone now in this room while this the sea is raging on, and I freak out. So I think in my mind that something was wrong with the alcohol that we had bought. And I had never prior to this experienced any what I would call panic or anxiety. You know, like I had had levels of anxiousness before, but for people who actually go day-to-day experiencing like generalized anxiety disorder or anything of that nature, you know that there's a very strong difference between having anxiety and then just getting overly nervous, or like the difference between getting really depressed, like deep in your bones, versus getting depressed or sad after a breakup, you know? Like, there's sort of the weird, we play this weird linguist game between terms like this, and they mean very different things to different people. So up until this point, I had never experienced true anxiety or panic. So I started feeling the anxiety building, which was a very confusing thing for me to feel. And in my mind, I had convinced myself that this alcohol was either poisoned or bad. So I tried to make myself throw up because he threw up. So I go into the bathroom and try, I'm shoving my fingers in my throat trying to get this stuff out of me because I think I'm dying. So I'm doing this for like 30 minutes until I can hardly breathe because I've been shoving fingers down my throat. There's acid coming up and I'm drunk. So I'm just so out of it. I'm dehydrated. I can hardly breathe. So the panic just keeps building and building and building, and to the point where I literally thought I was dying. You know, like it got to the point, and I had, you know, again, it's so weird even explaining a story like this, because of course there's been times in my life prior to it where I thought I was dying. You know, like you get drunk, oh my gosh, this is the end of the world, or you get high, or you get sped up on adrenaline, or whatever it might be. You know, people experience things where they think they're near death in some sense, which I had felt before, but never in this state of mind where I was just so driven to the edge and feeling completely out of control. And, like, there was nothing I could do. You know, like, I couldn't rationalize my way out of this. There was no one I could talk to. There was no resources. I'm alone at sea. And, like, I barely know the parents who I'm with on this trip. You know, I'm with my friend, and the other friend is with her boyfriend in the other cabin. So anyway, I'm freaking out and I think I'm dying. And I start, like, writing notes on my computer, like, to my family, like, saying, sorry I've been such a crappy kid growing up and for being so rebellious and mean and just rude to everybody. And, like, basically, like, writing this long list of apologies to my family and my friends and anyone who I might have wronged at any point. And it just became this super existential, surrealist moment of thinking that this was it. Like, I'm dying. I can't control anything. This is the end of my life. So I might as well just say sorry, because maybe I was, like, a really bad person. You know, like, that's how it felt, at least in that moment. So that goes on. I eventually type myself to sleep. You know, like, I don't even remember how I fell asleep. I woke up the next morning. It's like 7 a.m. I'm exhausted. I didn't even feel dehydrated when I woke up, which is the most confusing thing. You know, I just remember waking up feeling, breath of fresh air. This is amazing. I felt like there was no panic. There was no anxiety. It was like a fresh start to a day. And I thought back to the night before and thought, wow, that was a trip. You know, it must have just been something in the alcohol. Like, I'm all good. Like, I feel fine. Like, that was just like a really weird experience. So, you know, I drink some water, eat some whatever I ate for breakfast, and we get off the boat, jump in a cab. We start going to the airport, and in the cab, I start getting nauseous, and that's a totally normal thing. It's just like a hangover. You know, obviously I've drank before and experienced this before, but when the nausea came on, it triggered the same anxiety that I felt the night before, which was super confusing to me, again, because I had never experienced this before, and I had no rational way of understanding it, so I thought something was still wrong with me. So basically, it started the wheels turning again. You know, like, I spiraled out of control almost instantly. As soon as I started feeling sick, my brain, it was almost like a trigger mechanism from the trauma of the night before, and my brain clicked back into that state of mind that something was wrong. So I start freaking out in the car, thinking I'm dying again. We get to this airport. I literally, this is the part of the story that gets really weird. I start hallucinating, and to this day, I'll never know what this was, whether this was all created in my own mind because the chemicals in my brain were just firing off at on all pistons. I started to see trees and wildlife inside the airport when we got there. I saw deer running around, which I'll never forget. It was one of the most bizarre things ever to be sitting in a airport terminal and just to see deer hopping around. And I was like rubbing my eyes, like, what is going on in my mind right now? And so I'm freaking out. I'm running in circles. The parents who brought me on this trip, who owned this realty company that I work for, are looking at me like I'm insane. They have no idea how to react or what to do in this situation. Like I said, like, we didn't really know each other all that well. So my friend Leo, who is the son that I was friends with at the time, I'm still friends with him. But at the time, especially because we'd only been friends for like a year or so at this point, he's trying to help me, calm me down. He's actually explaining to me what he thinks is happening, which turns out he was right, because he had experienced a panic disorder and like anxiety in these different levels. So he could kind of see, as the wheels were turning in my mind and how I'm reacting, he saw that and tried to help me. He was trying to explain, like, you're okay, you're okay, you're okay. He was trying to help me with different mechanisms and all that. I wasn't having any of it. You know, I was lost in my mind, completely deranged. And the best part of this was I started running around looking for something for my stomach, because I had never experienced anything like this before. And I kept thinking the alcohol I drank was like poison, right? So I'm running around looking for something that could heal my stomach. And I'm reading labels, you know, like when you go to the airport and you see like the little concession stands, and I'm reading labels and boxes on the concession stand for something to help me. I can barely see. You know, everything's blurry. I'm blacking out. Like, I'm in and out of reality. You know what I mean? And I end up buying a box of pills and taking them. And Leo comes up to me and he's like, what did you just buy? Like, what are you taking? And he looks at the box, and I I had bought Midol, the women's, the period pills, basically, like, for help with menstrual cycles. And I had no idea. I even bought them. I literally didn't even look at the label. I was just reading the backs of the boxes to find something to help with stomachs. And I bought that box. He's freaking out. He's like, what are you doing, dude? Like, why would you, like, I have no idea what's going on. Needless to say, this is kind of like the end of this story. I won't keep going on. I could go on and on and on about the sort of micro stories within the story, but I get on the plane and the person I'm sitting next to on the plane is this calm older man. And he sees that I'm freaking the hell out and basically starts talking to me and saying, you're going to be okay, blah, blah. Like, he was very just calm demeanor. He knew what was up. He actually really helped me. I'll never know his name. I literally met him in that moment of panic. He calmed me down. I fell asleep. And when I woke up, he was already off the plane. We were getting off the plane. You know, we had landed in Philadelphia. So we landed. I get back to my house. Oh, and by the way, like, one other micro story from that whole incident at the airport where I'm panicking. I was calling my family because I hadn't had service on the boat, obviously. So I was calling my family at the airport, just telling them that I'm dying and that I'm so sorry and blah, blah. And they're crying on the phone. They have no idea what's going on. Like, I literally was calling my family just to tell them sorry about everything, that I don't know what happened to me and I made a mistake and all this stuff. So it was really, really just awful. Like, the worst trauma that I could have imagined, at least at this time, you know, in my own personal experience. So when I landed in Philly, got back to my parents' house where I was living still, and the panic just started right back up. As soon as I started to try to go back to sleep that night, it just started right back up, even worse than it was earlier, to the point where I needed to go to the emergency room. So my dad drove me there. I ended up not going in because I fell asleep when I got there, and my dad knew that there was something going on here in this sort of mental health capacity. So he talked to me that night, and the long story short is this went on a daily basis. Not a single day went by that I didn't experience this deep, deep traumatic level of panic for almost an entire year. So this cruise happened in January of 2012. I got medicated. They put me on Zoloft in, I want to say, September of 2012. So there was that, whatever that is, like a 7 month or 8 month period or so where every day I'd wake up, I'd go maybe an hour without panicking, then I'd have panic attacks, and they would just litter my mind throughout the day. And it got to the point where over the course of maybe 2 or 3 months of this, I had to break up with the girl I was with because I couldn't be with her anymore. I just couldn't function at any level. I was just overthinking everything. I was having panic attacks every day. Everything was just in disarray. I really didn't even know what was going on. I couldn't think straight. So broke up with her. So I was just going to community college at the time. You know, I wasn't away at college or anything like that. Just like a local community college I've been going to for the past year or so. Dropped out because I failed two classes of it. I mean, quote unquote, dropped out of community college. You know what I mean? Just stopped going. And I had to leave my job because I was literally getting to work and having to leave in the middle of the day randomly for these panic attacks. Like, I just had to start driving because I couldn't function. Like, I'd be in a room and just start freaking out of nowhere. And it just was, it was awful. I lost 30 pounds. I want to say like maybe 28 pounds or so in the first couple months. I was just skin and bones. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. Everything was just, it literally felt like it was going to be a matter of time that I ended up in an insane asylum. You know, I thought it was schizophrenia. You know, I wasn't really sure what had happened to me because I couldn't rationalize, like I've been saying. But every day it was just constant panic, you know, constant uncertainty of who I was, what I was doing. There's mass memory blackouts of this time for me where I just don't remember entire weeks and months of what I was even doing. And eventually I got put on medication. Zoloft really helped me, you know, like up until this point, at that point in my life, you know, I was super against medication and doing anything that way. I'd never really liked the idea of pills. You know, a lot of my friends had gotten into pills in their addictive phases growing up, and it was just a scary thing to me. You know, like, I think they're scary for a lot of people. So that was a point in my life where I knew I had to bite my pride, really, and just do it. And it definitely helped. I mean, it helped level me out you know, it got me to a baseline level, you know, toward the end of this tour, the end of 2012. And I was able to start functioning again day to day. But like the pills do for a lot of people, it cut out a lot of my capacity for emotional interactions and memory, really. Like it further worsened my memory. Every day kind of just felt like the same thing. You know, I was just repeating a cycle and I couldn't get very high. You know, it was great because I couldn't get my lows. You know, I wasn't having panic attacks every day anymore. I was still getting anxious, but the panic was gone virtually. But I also couldn't get, you know, like serotonin dumps because it controls this, your sort of output input levels of all that. So anyway, that happened. I eventually got off the pills the next year and I started to restabilize my life. And in that time, I found God again. You know, I started going to church again and really restructuring my entire belief system. This was a really weird time for me because I started to acknowledge for the first time in my life that growing up, I was so young when I rebelled against everything that I believed. I didn't have a full, you know, functioning brain to understand all of that. You know, at this time, I'm 21, I think. So I'm still not, you know, full functioning. But I realized, you know, I really needed to give it a shot, you know, like to actually, maybe there was something there that I missed because I was just a dumb teenager. So I dove in headfirst to theology. I got really into Calvinism and started listening to a bunch of different podcasts and YouTube shows and audiobooks and reading deeper into authors like C.S. Lewis and Jonathan Edwards and a bunch of different, your sort of classic Christian thinkers, writers, theologians, all that. So anyway, in the process of all of this, there was a girl who I had gone to church with growing up who was the pastor's daughter that I had known my whole life, who was coming home from being away at school. And I started crushing on her. We started dating very shortly after. And that was, it was cool because it was a time in my life where I was finding stability again. I was creating a worldview. I felt really good about myself. You know, I still had anxiety. I still had these issues, but I felt stable for the first time in years. And I started to kind of piece together a new community. Me and a few of my friends, including the girl that I was dating, we started a young adults group. And it was just our thing. You know, we did it our way. And it was, at one point it peaked and there was like 60, 70 people come in every week. And it was just, we met in a coffee house and it was a really, really cool, vibrant community. And I got really deep back into Christianity. Felt like this was sort of a hiccup in the road, you know, like that's sort of like a prodigal son story. And I felt that for years I rebelled and ran away from the worldview that I was handed growing up and had to hit rock bottom, you know, literally hit rock bottom in my sense of the world. Again, it's odd. It's odd telling this story to an audience of people who, when I have on different different individuals, whether it's through social media or journalism or some other area of expertise, you know, a lot of the people I do this podcast where they share their stories and it's about broadening perspective. And a lot of the perspective that I've gained for the past few years is to show, you know, again, just how good I had it growing up. When I look at a lot of the people I know now and a lot of the experiences of people I've known, it's hard to even know where to stop and start comparing because you really can't. You can't compare your experience to my experience and vice versa because in each of our own minds, you know, our experience is the one that we're given. You know, we're the sort of hero of our own story in a way. So even though, I mean, to someone on the outside looking in, I guess a lot of this is just coming off like this is just some suburban white kid who went through some existential crank and this is all like just another, like it's such a basic story. And I concede in a lot of ways my story is not really anything too insane, but to me it is. To me it's my story and I have to own that and I want to own it. It's not really something that I feel ashamed of in any capacity. It's just something that I know I have to be aware of when I'm dealing with people on the outside, especially people from less privileged backgrounds or disimpoverished areas and all that. Like there's a whole realm of perspective and storytelling that you have to be aware of. And I'm definitely becoming more and more aware of that as time goes by. So just to add that little caveat into all this, because I know how, just as I go on through the story, how it kind of comes off. So anyway, throughout this period of my life, I was super stable and all that, but it only lasted maybe 8 months, maybe 10 months until I started to kind of, the pieces of my actual temperament started to surface again. You know, the pieces of who I am as a person came back to the surface, you know, and I'm a very rebellious person. I'm a contrarian by nature. I'm someone who's always questioning everything. So as soon as I started to do that again, this is like post this new belief system that I developed, a lot of my life started to fall apart again. You know, like the relationship I was in started to get unstable because the girl I was with knew what she believed. You know, she was a Christian. She had this strong set worldview that she had her entire life. I was at the point now where I was just kind of, I had weaved in and out and in and out of different ideologies, you know, and throughout, in all this, I haven't even gotten into politics because honestly, politics in this sense are a little bit more boring to me from a personal perspective. So I had different political leanings throughout this rebellious phase. I'd go left to right to center, you know, anarchist to conservative, whatever it was, you know. And I had been seeing those shifts in my own life for a long time. So this just felt like another shift to me from a belief system perspective. And that was just terrible for the relationship because, you know, she wanted to know what I believed and what our relationship was going to look like. And I couldn't provide that for her. So we went a couple years of dating and really tried to work through things. And all the more while that was going on, you know, I was just becoming more and more progressive in my ideology again. You know, I was moving more to the left and questioning more things. You know, I was still interested in the framework of Christianity, but I was just moving it in a way that was not in the same, through the same lens as she was, you know, or the community that I was in was. So there was that whole thing, and eventually we broke up, and it was a really, really tough experience because it was just years of rebuilding, you know, this community and a lot of friends and family, and there was a stability that came with that that was really cherished, not just by myself and the relationship I was in, but by our families and the people that we went to church together with. And when we broke up, there was just a lot of weight that came with that. You know, it was a shift. It's kind of weird to say that again, because there's a lot of moving pieces in there that I'd have to extrapolate on. But I mean, she was the pastor's daughter, and I was involved. Like, I did worship at the church and ran this young adults group and all that. And we'd go hiking together and all that. So I was kind of like one of the quote unquote leadership figures, you know what I mean, in this space. And when we broke up, there was just a lot of disarray in the community, in my own life, and in the broader scope of that, the whole church. So anyway, that happened. And in the process of all this, you know, I had just started working at my dad's advertising agency. And I didn't know what I was doing in my life at the time. Again, super privileged position to be in because I was living at home. So my parents were providing for me. Like, I didn't have to pay rent or any of that, you know. And I quit that job working for the realty company the year before. So my dad, he started a food and beverage marketing advertising agency about, as of 2018, it was about 30 years ago at this point. It was like right around the time when I was born, and he was starting his marriage and everything. So this is like his whole life. You know, he's poured his whole life into this small business and super proud of it. It's amazing. You know, a lot of the work that he's done has been really incredible. And he's one of those people who anyone in the community that knows him has good stuff to say about him. And you know, I always looked up to my dad growing up. But through the rebellious phase, I just didn't want that same thing again. Like, I was sort of against this whole system of almost capitalism, I guess, as a whole, you know, or just consumerism as I saw it at the time. You know, I just really didn't want any part of it. So I never thought working for him was even an option. You know, I never went to school for it. It wasn't something I had expertise in. And he basically told me at this point, because I was trying to become stable and I was looking for work at the time, and he basically said, hey, if you want to intern here, like while you're doing odd jobs and like looking for more stable work, you know, you can just see how you like it type of thing. So I interned for 6 months or so unpaid just to kind of check it out. And I loved it. know, I really loved the people there, and I loved the type of creative work that it was, you know, social media and writing and coming up with ideas for stuff. It was just really, it sort of invigorated that part of my mind. So I eventually, this would have been 2014, eventually a position opened up for a social media manager because they were getting in more to social media marketing with their clients. And again, this is like smaller scaled clients. And I think a lot of people think when they think of food and beverage marketing corporations and a lot of startups, a lot of local regional companies. So like, so not huge, huge budgets, but like decent sized budgets, you know, like ones to actually start running big campaigns with on social media. So I had, the only experience I had had on social was from being on it from when I was a little kid and from doing promotional work, you know, through my own songwriting and for the shows I've been booking. So I had an understanding of how like ads worked and how to get people into and interacting with stuff on Facebook and everything like that. So I had a grasp for it, and it was a really small thing. You know, it was mostly like planning content calendars and really just kind of the more basic plans. So in the process of all this period of my life where I then break up with the girl I was with, and I'm still working at my dad's agency, I was there for, at this point of the breakup, 2 years, I want to say, and I just didn't know what I was doing in my life. You know, I felt like, what am I doing here? I'm working at my dad's company. I feel super privileged, and I don't have an expertise in what I'm doing. This isn't something I went to school for. Everyone that works here is an expert. You know, they're all artists and they're account executives and they're people that have mass experience at what they do, and they're amazing at what they do. And I'm just the boss's kid. So like, this was it's just really difficult for me internally. It's so weird having to caveat this, but like outside looking in, of course, it's like, oh, like, yeah, you're the boss's kid. Like, yeah, it must be really tough. But yeah, I mean, internally it was, because I'm wrestling with knowing that. You know, like, I don't want that. I don't want to have that label. You know, I don't want to have that be hanging over my head. You know, I felt like I could never really say anything or like have an opinion because, you know, I was just the boss's kid. So this sort of internal tension had been going on for a long time, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to quit or not. And I didn't know what to do because I had only had like 2 years of school under my belt and a bunch of random odd jobs. You know, like, I dipped my hand in a bunch of different pots around promotion and songwriting and landscaping, realty, maintenance. Like, there's all these different things where I was like, okay, like, could I go in this direction? Like, I don't really know. So all that to say, like, I've, at this point in my life, I was back into this uncertainty phase of just not knowing who I was and what I was going to do. But I did know that this tension of not knowing at this point, this is 2016, beginning of 2016, end of 2015, I knew that that's where I needed to be. Because at this point, I've been going through my life, my entire life, from growing up, back and forth, over and over again, not knowing what I thought about things. And I'd shift from one extreme to another extreme. I'd shift from extremely religious to extremely anti-religious, and extremely politically conservative to extremely politically progressive, et cetera, et cetera. And this went on for so many different phases of my life that at this point, I realized I need to stay in this tension. Like, I need to be right where I am right now. I need to be okay questioning things. I need to be interested. I need to be curious. I need to be okay with not knowing the broader truths of the universe. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just some guy. You know, like, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a religious expert or a non-religious expert. Like, I'm just some guy. And I need to really level out my existential angst in a productive way where I can just be a functioning person. So I made it to that point, and shortly after, I started dating Chelsea, who's my current fiance, who I get married to next month. Woot woot. So fell in love with her instantly. She shared that same mindset of just holding ideology and ideas and possibilities in the space, you know, holding it in an open hand rather than a closed fist, which was something that I wanted more than anything out of somebody to share my life with. And found that in her. You know, we had known each other for almost 10 years prior to that. She was a barista at the one coffee house that I used to host an open mic at and also just play open mic at. So we had a history, and I had sung a little bit with her little sister. Her sister was a songwriter herself. So it was great. Just jumped into dating her, and you know, flash forward a year from there into 2017, and that's when all the Steak'em stuff happened. So 2017, that summer, I was getting ready to like literally quit working for this agency that I work at. I just didn't know what I was doing there anymore. I was getting more and more anxious by the day, just not feeling like I fit in or belonged, and that I was wasting, more than anything, that I was wasting my dad's time and money. You know, like, my dad poured in so much time and so many resources into me working for him, and he believed in me. You know, anytime we talked about it, he'd always be like, you'll figure it out. You know, like, I'm not pressuring you. He'd always made it a point to tell me, you know, you don't need to do this. You don't need to take on this identity. I'll support you with whatever you want to do. And that was something I always, I valued it so highly. And also it guilt tripped me so bad because I felt like I wasn't offering the company anything of substance. You know, like, I was barely getting by with what I was doing, just like the sort of bare minimum social media type work, basically. The Steak'em thing happened in August of 2017. And that's a whole story in and of itself, but the long story short is that we had Steak'em as a client, and they had run the retainer for the year, so we didn't have any budget for ads or campaigns or anything like that, and we were trying to think of something we could do, like, in the meantime. So through some talks within the agency and with the people over there, I convinced them to let me run their Twitter account, and at the time, Steak'em's Twitter account had, like, maybe 1,000 followers, but no active followers. You know, like, probably most of those were bots and like old expired accounts because it hadn't been used in years. So I started just going on it and being a goon and trying to drum up some impressions and engagement. This was just all in my own free time because we didn't have a budget for it. So I just started doing it outside of work hours and some during work hours a little bit if I had some downtime. But it naturally just snowballed into what it became now. Basically, like, some of the initial pieces that got it to be what it is, I got involved with the online group Twinja, which just started interacting with them one day in October. And we just had a great time interacting on Twitter. I'm still friends with a lot of the people I interacted with that day through the brand account. And that impression rate, then, it kind of, because I was interacting with so many different people just from one day of being online, it garnered a lot of attention from more potential followers. And then the impressions kept going up from there, and it got more and more people's attention. And I just started to get more and more active on it, putting in probably 70, 80 hour weeks for a couple months in a row. And I kind of got obsessed. You know, I realized that this is an opportunity. This is something that I could really do something cool with. You know, like, it's an account, it's a company that's been around since 1975, and they're letting me have creative control in the content that I'm putting out. So I was able to run a lot of it without having to go through lines of approval and like white collar board meetings about strategy and all that. I just kind of skipped past almost all of that. So I just kept going and going, and momentum kept going up. We used this hashtag Verify Steak'em campaign, which was just an organic thing. It was never meant to be a campaign. It was just a talking point that we started pushing through the Twitter, and people just loved it. It was just like, I think it was in a lot of ways an escape from the toxicity of that social media platform where it's mostly political. It's mostly very divisive and polarizing. So this was a way that people could kind of blow off steam, you know, and it kind of just kept growing and growing to the point where some media picked it up, and eventually the account got verified in January this past year, 2018, and it just blew up from there. From, I guess, when I started on the account, probably like 1,000 followers, and by the time in January it got verified, I think it had like 15,000. It got like 500 million organic impressions through like the media that it was published in, and all the Twitter stuff. So it was just a really cool experience that I would not have been able to do without the amazing community that I kind of just fell into on Twitter. And that was something that really shaped my entire attitude toward work and who I am and what I want to do. It gave me more clout and credibility to my job. It just opened up a whole new outlet of space in conversations of social media. I have a voice. You know, I have something that I understand, and that the people who previously would have just looked at something like Twitter or it just maybe social media marketing in general and looked down on it as if it's like not very effective, or they don't really understand how it works, how online culture works. You know, like, this is, hey, I can put this in front of people and say, this is how it works. You can create content that people want to see. You can create relationships with people that they want to have. It doesn't have to be you just shoving ads, you know, and like really crappy, hey, fellow kids type of ads in people's faces. So that's pretty much what brought me to where I am right now. And I've always wanted to start a podcast. I got into podcasts in 2011-ish, and it's always been something that I've been interested in. I just love ideas. I love sharing ideas, my own ideas. I love hearing other people's ideas, and I just like to talk. If you haven't gathered that already, I was not planning for this podcast to be as long as it is, and it is, because I like to talk. I know that I'm obnoxious. You know, I'm very self-aware of a lot of the inherent character and temperamental flaws that I possess. And thankfully, with the community, not just online through the feedback of the podcast, but the people I know in real life, there's a lot of people that I know who are upfront and honest with me about how I come across and the way I talk about certain things. And I'm always just trying to improve, just generally as a person. And I feel like this podcast for me in a lot of ways is that. Here's a way that I can not wind up some bitter old man one day, just waking up one day and realizing that I have been stuck in my own head for years with what I believe, and now I'm just trapped. You know, like, this is my way of getting ideas out there and getting new ideas in. And it's a way to share those ideas and share that process. And that's what it's all about. So, you know, I really, really am thankful to have all the opportunities that I've had. Life is just really bizarre in that way, you know. Like, I get into this a lot in the podcast with different guests about free will and just how so much of what we are is an accident of birth and community, where we grow up and our temperaments and our biologies. And these are all things that are out of our control in a large sense. So I'm really thankful every day to have the life that I've been given and the opportunities that I've been given. And I want to make sure that with that, I'm providing a platform for as many people as I can, and a space for learning and understanding and bridging gaps of polarization. So this is just a little bit, I guess, it's been like an hour. I'm not even looking. So yeah, it's been like an hour of me rambling a little bit about myself. Hopefully this gives some of you context to why I am the way I am, like why I'm interested in certain topics over other topics. This sort of all weaves in together the pieces of just my identity as a person. And, you know, there's certain podcasts I listen to just for the sake of politics. Like, I listen to political podcasts for that. I listen to spiritual podcasts for that. You know, I listen to sort of general conversationally based podcasts to blow off steam and to learn a little something about whatever it might be they're talking about. There's different areas of outlets where we can learn and go to for different stuff. And I want to make sure, like, with this, that I'm being true to myself. And who I am is someone who is caught between all these different tensions. I'm caught between tensions of the family and the community I was raised in and their more fundamentalist belief systems. I'm caught between that and the worldview and the friend circles that I've cultivated as an adult, which is much more progressively minded. So I'm caught between that tension, and that translates into religion and spirituality, politics, and just everyday living and ethical decisions. So that's pretty much all I want to share, I guess. So, if you made it this far, that's awesome. You know, I really appreciate each one of you for listening and for being part of this whole process with me. So, yeah, party.